This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're revisiting the theme of PTSD with an incredible author called Mary Firestone, which, side note that I didn't get a chance to tell her at the time, I love a good name. And there's something about Mary Firestone that really kind of rolls off the tongue. I'm like, yeah, that belongs on a book. Like, I want to see that in print more. And I was so blown away by her insights on PTSD in general and all the angles we were able to tackle it from, you know, talking about many of the challenges of this condition, but also how much she learned about herself and how much growth she found in working on her mental health. And so this is an incredibly positive, uplifting, inspiring interview that I'm feeling very pumped after having. And I think that's particularly worth acknowledging when looking at certain things she's been through that contributed to the PTSD experience. And that includes childhood sexual abuse. That includes being the victim to really multiple natural disasters, both the 2017 California wildfires and in 2018, a mudslide. So I'm really glad that we've managed to cover this condition in so many forms when so often it can be as part of the stigma, victim to stereotyping and narrow ideas of, you know, what PTSD can relate to. And in particular, our guest talks about how frustrating she found it as what people can, you know, tack on with it. You know, that there's the label of the condition, but then there's all the kind of expectations of, okay, what is this person's life going to be now? To what extent can they get the help? To what extent can they heal? And she was very proud to smash through those kind of expectations, those limiting beliefs, and, you know, learn so much that went into her book as a result. So with that all said, I know you'll get so much from this interview. The other thing that I think is worth quickly mentioning as well is that when this episode goes out, it will be the final week of season 2 of Dating Games, the Modern Relationships podcast, my other show. And so this is a good chance, if you've never listened to it before and you want to hear me talk to comedians and have some really fun conversations about the many, many pitfalls that can come up in dating relationships and some, you know, and plenty of fascinating things that the guests share of, you know, what they've learned through them. The way I describe that makes it sound kind of similarly kind of documentary-esque style that this show can be. It's a lot more kind of conversational. It's a lot more kind of like witty banter and telling ridiculous dating stories thrown in there as well. So yeah, if you want to go hear me host a quite distinctly different, but I think complementary show, now is a good chance to reflect on season 2 and so many of the very cool comedians, many of whom have also been on this show. So you can find that by searching Dating Games or indeed my name in your favorite podcast app. So that's something to check out if you want some more free content. Also, if you're subscribed to our Apple Podcast subscription for bonus ad-free content, that applies on both shows. So you can get the most of that there as well. So with that all said, we'll get into this conversation with the brilliant Mary Firestone in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name is Mary Firestone, and I grew up in Washington, D.C. with parents who were educated and loving. And also, ironically, my mother is an art therapist who deals with children with PTSD now. When I was growing up, she was focused more on her art work, and my dad was a businessman, and they were very busy working and traveling. And my first experience around mental health or lack thereof was I was molested by someone who was working in our house when I was 7. And my parents we talked about it. I told him what happened, but there was never any therapy around it. I mean, the man was fired and left my house, but still there was never any kind of follow-up to that. So that was my first experience, kind of now that I look back thinking, wow, like I have an almost 9-year-old and a 4-year-old daughter, and how differently I would handle that aftermath. So I guess it was kind of a lack of mental health awareness or support.
Yeah, no, I can see that. And when you went through that experience, can you remember what your level of understanding was of what had happened to you?
Yeah, I think, you know, they had definitely educated me and my sister. I have a little sister who's 2 years younger. So I knew enough to know to tell him to stop. I remember running into the bathroom after and seeing my little sister, who was 5 at the time. I was like, I think that I just got molested, you know? So I knew enough to know what had happened and that it was bad and that it was wrong. And my parents, you know, there was like a conversation, but I wonder too, if it's like, you know, a couple of things, like the era, like the time, this was in the 80s. So it wasn't as much a part of the conversation. And also growing up in the family I grew up in, you know, kind of a WASPy family, if it just, you know, we don't talk about that kind of stuff, or maybe there's a stigma around it. Which, you know, I'm so glad that you're doing podcasts like this so that people can begin to talk about it. And there's not a stigma. And unfortunately, it's extremely prevalent. So the more we talk about it, the more we can heal it and the more we can stop it.
For sure. And I think there definitely can be various factors that can exacerbate the stigma. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. one of them is this mentality of something like that doesn't happen to people like us.
Yeah.
And of course, as a parent, and you love your kid, you want them to be safe. You know, such a big part of motherhood is that fear of, are my young kids going to be safe? And yes. then to be confronted with, this is a situation that's so horrific that happened mm-hmm. within our home, the one place where I thought, you know, maybe they're safe here under my roof. How do you wrap your head around that?
Yeah, I've been thinking about it a lot, you know, with the healing that I've done after the mudslide too. It's sort of, you know, and doing some of the therapies that I tried and healing from that, the mudslide, that trauma was healed, or, you know, not that you're like healed, check, you're done, but, you know, I've worked through that. And then it's amazing how these experiences that happened so long ago pop up. Although I've done years of therapy and other kinds of work around them, there was still another layer to clear. And I think to your point,
yeah.
it happened in my home. So that, I think that was big. That was scary, like in my bedroom. So, and that there was no clearing around that. I think about how it could have been different, you know?
Yeah. It can so totally undermine your feeling of safety. And I also want to note there what you mentioned about, you know, finding these additional things in therapy, because I relate to that a lot. And I feel like that's something that's often not talked about, that one of the challenges of therapy can be just how many additional things you find to work on. And it can make you feel like, am I making progress or am I treading water?
Yeah, definitely. Which is why, you know, I got my master's degree in psychology. And by the time I was finished with that program, I knew I was living in California at the time, and I had just been introduced to different kinds of energy work and different kinds of healing that kind of dealt with, you know, the physical body and the metaphysical body. So I knew by the time I was finished that I wanted to do something beyond traditional talk therapy, which can be extremely helpful and has been extremely helpful for me. And there's this whole other world that I think can get underneath some of the mental processes that we put in place to keep ourselves safe, or we think we're keeping ourselves safe, you know? But so that has been really incredible, kind of diving into the subconscious through these different modalities.
Mm-hmm. And something else I wanted to ask you about just before we move on from some of these childhood experiences, in terms of your parents, did mm-hmm. they believe you straight away? And what was their kind of initial reaction to what happened?
Yeah, luckily they did believe me, and they, you know, they took action right away. So, and they are very loving and supportive parents, and we have a great relationship now. I feel like it's gotten better and better as we've all done more of our own work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that's something you talk about in your work, is how, you know, coming from a loving family, again, you can assume, oh, certain things I might be shielded from.
Yeah, but really, you know, these kinds of traumas affect everybody. And it doesn't matter where, what socioeconomic bracket, where, what part of the world you live in. Unfortunately, we're human. We're all going to experience trauma mm-hmm. in some way, shape, or form. It's just part of being alive. So how do we heal and learn from that, those experiences?
Mm-hmm. And what was the thing you were going to say before I interrupted you?
Well, I was going to say that they did believe me. They did take action. And yet, I have this memory of having to, like, drive this man and his wife from my house to where they moved, which I'm like, why would I, you know, should not have had any more contact with that person.
So, wow. So what your parents, so this was when you were 7, right? So this was your parents offering to help him move?
There must have been something, because I remember the apartment building and having to like see this person again. So again, you know, I'm sure they would do it very differently now. And as a parent now, I, you know, you're like, really? I'm entrusted with these two tiny people and I still don't know exactly what I'm doing all the time. So you're making the best choices and decisions that you can at the time. I'm sure they would do it differently now.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of the reasons why we were saying off air, like there is a certain privilege to having these conversations, as tricky as yeah. they can be. It's facing a reality that is so much more common than is often acknowledged. Like I know in the US, one of the stats is around victims of childhood sexual exploitation or assault, with men specifically, is 1 in 6. And for women, yeah. it's even higher. And so that yeah. is so common. And yet it's more to do with the not talking about it than, you know, whether or not it's common, that
right.
we can be so shocked by these things happening in our family that mm-hmm. whilst it's not, you know, excusing that your parents putting you in a situation again with him, partly I can see how that might have come about, that, you know, how, like, do any of us know what we would do? And it can yeah. be so shocking. Even though, you know, it shouldn't be, if it was talked about just how frequently these kind of experiences happen.
Yeah, which I really, you know, I am thinking back, I get more about childhood, but I went to an all-girls private school in Washington. Why wouldn't there be more conversation about this? You know, at this all-girls school, they have plenty of funding, plenty of resources, plenty of access. You know, I don't even remember, maybe by the time we were in high school there, they had someone come, you know, the guys that are angels that dress up in all the pads and, you know, grab you and you have to fight your way off kind of thing. But I feel like we should start the conversation earlier and younger, you know?
Yeah, I totally agree. And so often the pushback against this can be when it's introduced as part of sex education. That's certainly in this part of the world often how it comes up, as, you know, younger children being taught about what's appropriate. And people mm-hmm. can kind of assume of like, oh no, but, you know, children shouldn't be knowing about sex at a certain age. But really, when you look into the education, and I've been able to work on some of it, a lot of it is around, you know, showing like a cartoon drawing, and is it appropriate for somebody to touch you here? And there's like a circle and the kids need to, you know whether that's a yes or a no. And that can seem to us adults a kind of arbitrary conversation maybe, or perhaps one that we, you know, we really don't want to think about just how vital that could be. You know, and so maybe we don't want to have the conversation, but somebody needs to.
I couldn't agree more. And I was struggling that within myself about talking to my children about, you know, this is your private and no one can touch you. And even, you know, recently thinking about that experience when I was 7 and realizing that my son is about to turn 9. And we talked about it a little bit because I'm like, he should know. I want him to know. I want him to be safe. If anything ever were to come up like that, tell me. So we have this open dialogue, which I hope will continue. I know he's only 9, but you know, just that there's safety there. Also just really thinking about who I allow with my children alone, things like that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's horrible to, you know, to acknowledge the need for that kind of carefulness, but it is so important. I also just want to quickly clarify what I mentioned about cartoon drawings. They are closed cartoon drawings in case I'm going to fail to win anyone over to that argument by them assuming it might be something different. But yeah, so this is, it's so important. So thank you for sharing that. And in terms of then you get older, you then go on to study clinical psychology. There's an ongoing interest in psychology for you. Could you share a bit about, you know, as you got older, did any other kind of things come up, or were there any conversations around mental health as you went off to college?
Yeah, so after the 7-year-old experience, I had 2 more, unfortunately, at 13 and 18 instances of sexual abuse. So by the time I went to, and again, no mental health follow-up, but when I went to college, that was the first time that really it was talked about. And, you know, I had other friends that had had similar situations, and Princeton offers a free counseling service. And I marched myself right in there. So that was my first experience with a therapist, Brenda. She was great. Mm-hmm. And that really started opening up so many doors for me. We had a peer educated sexual harassment, rape, I'm trying to remember what the acronym stood for, educational service that I took part of and became a leader for. We had Take Back the Night, which is a march that was started in the 1970s, and they do it on college campuses. And basically, you know, a big group marches all around campus and people take turns telling their stories. And the idea is kind of what we're talking about, like speak it, let it be known, don't hold it, you know, and there's like a healing in the speaking of it. So yeah. College was amazing for me, and that kind of validation of what I'd gone through in terms of resources and support. And then moving to California was really, I mean, changed my life, I think, just living here and being exposed to all different kinds of practices and people and open-mindedness and open-heartedness. So then it continued. And yeah.
Yeah. And I have so much respect for Take Back the Night as a movement. I think it's such an incredible beacon of, you know, standing up and saying, yes, these experiences can be really common, and there's great strength in finding that you're not alone. But also that changes nothing about how unacceptable they are, how, you know, every person should have the right to walk home and feel safe. The cover of darkness in any form shouldn't be some kind of cloak for this criminal behavior. And so it's so great that you found that. And in terms of these experiences you've mentioned, do you mind sharing a little bit more about what happened in these instances?
One was at 13, it was like the, you know, an older friend, not really my family, but we kind of knew him. At like a
family,
it was
friend.
The whole thing was just so inappropriate. I think my friend and I were like, you know, the cocktail waitresses at their parents' cocktail party. And it's, you know, we're 13 passing out drinks. And that was the first time he brought us drinks, you know, rum punches that were delicious. but I had no experience with alcohol. So that was when I was 13. And then, and he, again, there was some part of me that knew enough to say, like, you know, get off of me or get out of here or something. And then he lost interest and went off. So thank goodness. And then when I was 18, it was more like a date rape scenario with, you know, a drinking game, somebody that I knew, but not that well, was left alone with him. And, you know, so that happened. And then I did actually confront him the next day. But it, again, it's that mixture too of like the gray space when there's drinking involved and when you know them and like that kind of guilt around, did I do something? Could I have made a different decision? Is it my fault? And that's something that when I did MDMA therapy, it was so clear to me somehow that it was like the mudslide was a force of nature. You know, you can't stop the mudslide from coming down the hill. Whatever was moving through those men was a force of nature. And I just happened to be in their path. So there was something that was very like depersonalizing about that, you know, seeing it in that context. It was really helpful because for sexual abuse, I feel like it's probably pretty common to think like it's personal because it is so personal on the one hand. But for me, and like, I mean, in the MDMA, realizing like it really wasn't personal.
And a very common part of trying to wrap your head around how did this happen is questioning, you know, was I complicit in it happening? And, you know, that's not true. And yet it's such a common thing to question. I also want to pick up on what you mentioned there about this idea of a gray area, because I think this can be a really difficult thing to address, because so often the idea of there being a gray area does get weaponized against victims of sexual assault. And it's used, you know, whether it's a way to blame them, whether it's a way to excuse certain behavior, it's really dangerous. You know, like an example that springs to mind for me is, you know, how much context plays a role. So, you know, buying somebody a drink when they're underage versus buying somebody a drink when they're overage is a clear one. There's also less clear times when, let's say, you're on a date and you're buying somebody a drink. Okay, well, does it seem like they've had enough? If something then goes on to happen, to what extent can they consent? And there can be nuances there of, if you're going on a date with someone you're in a relationship with, you can potentially be a lot more confident that they are really consenting and that they're not too drunk to consent than if it's someone you've just met for the first time. You don't have the context of, you know, how much drink affects them, for example. And so there can be, you know, I'm reluctant to even call it a gray area, but there can be so many factors in here. And unfortunately, within that, you can find yourself being caught up in blame and wondering like, oh, what should I have done differently? And so, you know, how much of that was a factor for you?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, in reflecting on the three instances of abuse, the 7-year-old, you know, innocent, of course, like, nothing I could have done. 13 even, no, nothing. He was 10 years older than me. It was really, it's that 18-year-old one that, you know, because I was, you know, I could drive. I did drink. I was playing a drinking game. I mean, it was so cliche, unfortunately, in a lot of ways. And I think you're right. It's so dangerous. And I hate that I even said the gray zone but that is something that did plague me for a long time. Luckily at college too, there was so much offered in terms of, they even did a whole presentation to the freshman class called, what was it called? Like Sex on a Saturday Night, I think was the name of it. And they acted out, you know, a scene of a girl getting too drunk and getting raped. So it was more of a conversation, but it's like, oh, what? Sorry, I'm just getting frustrated because it's like girls should be able, boys should be able to drink and feel safe. And so clearly it plagued me. And I think in the recent, as I mentioned, in these recent therapies, decades later, I have found freedom from that kind of self-blame.
Yeah, no, that's so good to hear. And I'm also delighted to hear that your school did take some of that initiative of like having a play, having something that could be very, you know, practically absorbing of, okay, what are the real life situations you're unfortunately going to maybe come across?
Absolutely. And when I think about it now, I mean, I went to Princeton, which is like a very traditional, in a lot of ways, like a very, even when I was there, kind of male school, it felt like in a lot of ways. So now that I'm thinking about it, I was pretty progressive 20 years ago. I just ate myself.
No, I'll say I definitely think so. And it's, you know, it's good that you have that perspective that you can look back and see, you know, the victories that were there, you know, and no doubt like therapy's been a part of, you know, finding the good in some of these difficult times. And unfortunately, we have more to fast forward to. So could you talk to me a little bit about 2017 and by contrast, where you're at in your life to kind of set the scene there?
Yeah. So my family, we made the move to Santa Barbara and found this like the most idyllic little farmhouse that had been there since like 1840, like that, you know. And
it was your family at this point is who?
My family at that point was my then husband, Napper, and my son, who was 3 at the time, Ever. And we found, so this perfect old farmhouse, and it had a little guest house and had a pool and this oak grove that he could run around in. And it was in the best public school district. And, you know, Oprah had her estate nearby. It was very idyllic. I know. It was nice. So, you know, it was kind of a dream come true. And we had just finished making some renovations. And literally, I think we slept in the house 2 nights before the Thomas Fire, which burned, I think, over almost 300,000 acres. We might want to double check that, but a lot of Southern California. So we were evacuated for a month, pretty much. We left, went back to stay with family. And then we came back in January, slept there 2 more nights. And on the 2nd night, there was a warning that there was going to be a potential debris flow because it was going to rain. And growing up on the East Coast, I had no idea what a debris flow was. It didn't sound that bad. Maybe a little water will come in under the door or something. And in the middle of the night, I woke up. I don't know why. I was pregnant too at the time with my daughter. And we hadn't had a chance to put curtains in yet because we just moved in. And literally I saw a tidal wave of mud. We had this cool like daybed thing outside and it was like 50 feet in the air, just hurtling towards us. And I screamed and Napper ran to go get our son Ever, whose bedroom was upstairs. And I didn't even have time to follow him because walls had crushed in and mud was up to my waist and furniture and boulders and glass. And so I had to run the other way, which was back to my bathroom. And there was a window there. And I literally, it was like the apocalypse. I don't know if you ever saw that Naomi Watts tsunami movie, but that's what it looked like. I saw my guest house go flying down in a river of mud on my left that my mother was supposed to be sleeping in. Thank God she wasn't. On my right, I saw my 2-story house had ripped off and spun around backwards. And my son's bedroom was the window looking back at me. And I thought that he was in it. It was terrifying. So I was trapped for 5 hours on my bathroom counter. The mud stopped like an inch below the countertop. And after about an hour, I could hear my son and Napper. So at that point, I knew they were alive, which was good. I mean, beyond good. That was the greatest relief I've ever known. But then we're still trapped and there's gas. I could smell gas. The mud was toxic with sewage and electrical wires. And so I did a lot of praying that night. I did a lot of like all of the practices that I'd ever been taught or practiced. I had a little bottle of essential oils on my bathroom counter and I smelling the oils. I was trying to meditate and kind of in and out through that night because it got dark again. It was light because there was a huge gas explosion. So it lit up the whole sky with this eerily beautiful orange light, which again, there's so many what ifs in my story that night that wound up with everyone being alive. And I know for a lot of trauma survivors and people that have lost loved ones, the what ifs don't end well. My what ifs wound up with me being alive and my family being alive.
And the way you tell that is just so vivid that I can see the kind of slow motion that can kick in when you're in a situation like that and you have seconds to make life-changing decisions. And, you know, certain things like you being a step further over to one side could have changed everything. And, you know, seeing your son's bedroom window drift past you, I can only imagine how terrifying that must have been.
It was. And it's, you know, like, oh my God, is this really happening? And this is happening to me. And I've been reading a book. My sister and I and some friends had formed a self-help book club. And we were reading some like weighty book on karma. So I was reading about karma, you know, that night before I'd gone to bed. And there were moments in that bathroom. I'm like, what is my karma if this is...
Oh my God.
You know, I'm like, what did I do in the last life?
Yeah, maybe not the book you needed fresh in your mind that day.
No, but, you know, at the same time, you know, as I went through the healing, the flashes that happened that night for me in the dark, it's hard to explain, but I really feel like I felt very protected.
But you must have felt so overwhelmed to be alive.
So overwhelmed to be alive. And in the aftermath, which was, I mean, I definitely had PTSD, I had nightmares, I was covered in poison oak because it was in the mud. And I'd been like, you know, in the mud up to my belly button almost. So if the nightmares didn't wake me up, the poison oak woke me up. We had lost our biggest asset, our house. Insurance was telling us that they weren't going to pay us at the beginning. And then they did. But it was really overwhelming and scary and horrible. And then at the same time, these wonderful things were happening. It was so weird, actually. It's like I would think something or wish something and it would happen. It's almost like, and I talk about this in the book a little bit, but in that state of trauma where you're just like, your intellect and rational mind is just collapsed or turned off because you're just so raw. It was almost like I felt like I had some connection to, I don't know, some greater power.
I know what you mean, though, because I've heard often people talk about it as like a post event clarity, that when something so mind-blowing like that happens to you, it does shrink your world down because you're reliving the moment and it's very difficult to think of anything but that, and PTSD only exacerbates that sensation. And yet there can also be this clarity that's very helpful of, okay, my son and my husband are alive, I'm alive. Yeah. There are things I can cling to, even in this really difficult time when I don't know where we're going to live. I don't know, you know, are my neighbours okay? Are other people okay? Yeah, so it's a familiar story to me, that part of it. And I just wanted to ask as well, how did you get out of the house in the end?
So at some point during the night, I saw like a flashlight and I would like swing my pregnant self from the bathroom counter to the windowsill and kind of hang out. And it was a fireman who was, you know, several football fields away. And I screamed and he was like, oh, we'll be back to get you in the morning kind of thing. And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, get in here.
And did your family know you were okay at that point? So you'd heard them, had they heard you?
Yes, we screamed back and forth. They also, they were in the upstairs bathroom. So good to know.
And so a natural disaster. They were also trapped, right?
Trapped in the bathroom upstairs. But go in the bathroom. It's a very safe place to be, apparently. So hours went by. And then in the morning, when it was daylight, there were helicopters coming and I could see them rescuing some of my neighbors from their roofs, where they had run up to the top of their roofs, but they didn't see me. And then eventually this guy comes like charging through the mud and waders, and his name was Orion, and he rescued me. He got surfboards out of like the garage had been all blasted open, and took surfboards and laid them on the mud so I could walk on them. And then he put me on the back of a fireman who carried me the rest of the way out. And my daughter, her name is India, and her middle name is Orion after him. And he's actually come and met her, and we still text and are in touch. So he actually lost his dad in a mudslide a few years prior to the Montecito mudslide. So he's a hero. So Orion Womack rescued me.
Oh, wow. You know, that's really beautiful. And I'm reminded of, I did a interview previously about 9/11. And, you know, even living so far away, you know, I think we're all haunted by what happened on that day. And again, there was that contrast. So many horrific things happened. And at the same time, there were all these very human moments of connection. People have described it to me as like a magic, like you don't know how else to describe how people can really come together when they have to. And how, you know, even just you've described there, someone that had already been devastated by a mudslide, you know, had lost people to it and was able to save you. There's something that doesn't quite feel coincidence when you hear about events like this, natural disasters, terrorist incidents, you know, such life-changing occurrences. Mm-hmm. And there are parts of it that don't feel like a coincidence. And how do you explain them? You know, but maybe that's the hope you cling to.
Yeah, I do think there is magic and in a good way that happens. And that definitely happened, yes, with Orion rescuing us. And then, you know, strangers. I had like every pregnant woman's maternity jeans in Santa Barbara brought to me. You know, people were that didn't know me, strangers were sending toys to my son and bringing us dinners and offering their homes. And yeah, there's something, I did actually study that a little bit too, this idea of what happens to people in trauma and disasters. And a woman named Rebecca Solnit, she's really studied it. And what she's found is that in the wake of natural disasters, terrorist attacks, things like that, that the true human condition is one of support and wanting to connect and help. You know, I think there's this fear that maybe we all have that we just, you know, be out for ourselves or whatever. But no, like the opposite.
I think there's almost like an instinct to counterbalance it, that we can somehow become the best of what people are at times like this. And you've shared a little bit about the symptoms you had of PTSD following this, certain things like the nightmares, reliving certain elements of the emotions of all that happened. What was the process like in terms of diagnosis and the support you were able to get?
The first therapy that I did right after the mudslide was EMDR, which I did with a therapist. And that really helped me break the nightmare loop. I also did some cranial sacral work, which sometimes I think after an extreme traumatic event, especially if it's physical, just to be able to like lie there and not talk was really healing for me. And then I did have a traditional kind of talk therapist, and I think she named it, you know, PTSD. And I knew from my studies too that what was happening to me was I was stuck in a lot of reactionary, I was fearful of weather. We got to actually stay in a beach house for a while, which was a beautiful, magical thing that happened. And yet at night I would be like terrified that a tsunami was going to come up, you know, the waves were going to come into the house, things like that. So I knew that I was experiencing it. And then about a year later, I was at an event with a woman running for city council or something, and she started talking about mudslides. And I had a full-blown panic attack in the middle of the event, you know, completely collapsed, couldn't move, my vision blurred. I got, you know, it was all the symptoms. At the time, I was like, did I eat something? Am I sick? What happened? And then I realized when another one happened about a month later that a woman started talking about ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. And I felt myself go into a panic attack again. And then I realized, oh, I'm having panic attacks and there's more work to be done here in healing the PTSD. So.
And there you go, even with your background of psychology, even with all you knew about PTSD, there was still that, you know, we can still find ourselves leaning towards, oh, there must be a physical explanation.
Totally, right? Do I have food poisoning? No.
Yeah, that would be a pretty unusual incident of food poisoning from what I know.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty extreme.
Yeah. And so through this, you also got to connect with so many other people that have been through different experiences related to PTSD. How did you find that?
Yeah, when I going through my own healing and the PTSD, and then I got quite frustrated with the PTSD label because I felt like it was a curse. And I mentioned earlier, you know, that yes, I did. There was some aftermath that was really hard and unpleasant, to say the least. But there were also these incredible experiences of connection and support and really knowing who my friends were, who my people were, like who really stepped up and who was there and who like couldn't deal. I feel like there also was this gift in recognizing the fragility and the impermanence of life and how that somehow made it so much more beautiful for me. Mm-hmm. So I started thinking about post-traumatic growth, and that's when I started really interviewing a lot of friends. One of my closest friends in Santa Barbara had lost a baby when he was just a month old. And we really bonded a lot over, I mean, completely different traumas, but, you know, we really bonded in the healing. So she was, Brianna was my first interview. And from there, I interviewed, you know, all kinds of survivors who had not only survived, but had thrived in the, you know, in the healing from the trauma. One of the most inspiring people that I spoke with is Dr. Edith Eger. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with her work, but she's a Holocaust survivor who then moved to California and has had a thriving practice, psychology practice. And she's written two books. One's called The Choice and the next is called The Gift. And it's this idea of, you know, all of us will be victimized in our lifetimes because that's part of the human experience. But we have the choice to remain victims or to heal and move forward and integrate this experience into a more dynamic life. So mm-hmm. she just, I'm like, my goodness, if Dr. Edie can do it and can say this, then, you know, so can I. And that's a part of the reason I wrote the book too. Like, so can you. If I can do it, if Dr. Edith could do it, if all these other people can do it, you know, you're not alone and it's possible. You can do it.
Yeah, yeah. It's so true. And yeah, that's so inspiring to hear. And, you know, of course, I agree with you about, you know, the label. Labels in general is something we so often discuss as how helpful can they be. In many ways they are. In many ways they can be a necessity in healthcare settings to getting certain kinds of treatment. And yet there's still, you know, clearly areas to develop. And, you know, for example, the including the word disorder. I think PTSD is perhaps one of the ones that is clearest and most, in some ways, ordered, right? It's one of the mental health conditions that are most explainable in terms of cause and effect of certain traumas leading to certain reactions and how many of those reactions are protective towards us not getting further traumatized, us having the space to kind of heal more gradually over something that we can't, you know, quite literally we can't wrap our heads around immediately. It wouldn't be possible. And mm-hmm. so where does that word disorder fit into it?
Mm. That's a good question, Bobby.
I'm not expecting you to answer the question. I don't think there is an answer, which is why it's important, you know, to keep talking about it, because things will move forward in the same way certain conditions have been renamed over the years and other conditions have been, you know, better recognized and divided up, you know, to be more accurate. So I think there's further to go, but I'm so glad that, you know, through your writing, you're helping kind of pass on so much of what you learned. And I think in particular with PTSD, there can be such a misconception of what causes it, that we can get into the stereotypes of, oh, it's certain kind of traumas. And, you know, is my trauma severe enough? You know, I spoke to Manya Chilinski, who survived a terrorist attack, and it was the Boston Marathon bombings. And one of the biggest questions that haunted her was, I don't think I was close enough to it. I didn't get a physical injury. You know, all these things in her head of, I don't think I had it bad enough to have PTSD. You know, it's, we can feel sometimes like we have to deserve a label or deserve the help.
Right.
And the reality is trauma is distinct to each of us. It's not comparable.
It's not. And something that Dr. Edie said too is, you know, your trauma is the worst because it happened to you. You know, there's no hierarchy of suffering and trauma. It's the worst because it's yours. And yeah, you can experience trauma just in the witnessing of someone else's trauma. So yeah.
There's so many ways we can find trauma. And so I'm so grateful for your book. Could you share a little bit more about where people can find it? It's going to be available for pre-order when this episode comes out, and it will be released on the 23rd of August.
That is correct. Yes. The book is called Trusting the Dawn, How to Choose Freedom and Joy After Trauma. And the title really is about that. I mean, I was sitting in the dark waiting for the dawn so I could physically see. And also this idea of like when we're in the aftermath of trauma, it can feel really dark. And the idea is that the dawn always comes. Trust that it's coming. There is light on the other side of the healing. So you can find it on my website, maryfirestone.co, not com. Someone already had that. And then my sister and I have a website called firestonesisters.com, where we have information about retreats that we have been running for, gosh, a decade. And we have an essential oil-based perfume as well that's designed to make you feel good, not just smell good. So
I love that. Well, thank you so much for sharing. It's been great chatting to you.
Thank you, Bobby. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.